Right, this passage is, I find, a little bit confusing, but it's so, so exciting. I think there's much riches for us today. I want to start with a little bit of a mind exercise. I need you to think. What I want you to do is to call to mind or decide which one of your high school teachers you most admired. Okay, there's probably a number, but which one you most admired. So get someone in mind. If you're homeschooled, I'm sorry. Maybe think about yourself. Okay, so has everyone got someone in mind? Now, with that person in mind, I want you to start to think through what it was about them that made them most admirable. This is where this mind experiment could backfire, because I'm going to take a punt that it was not necessarily the teacher who was the most cutest, or best looking, or handsome. It wasn't necessarily the teacher who drove the coolest car. Perhaps not even necessarily the teacher who was most organised in terms of, you know, the structure of their classes and marking assignments and stuff. Possibly not even the teacher who was on top of their subject the most. Perhaps if it was one of those few things, maybe that was more incidental to their greatest quality, which I'm betting was that they had a personal interest in you. That they cared about your life, not just about your grades in their subject. That they noticed stuff about you, how you're going. Said hello to you outside the classroom, maybe even pulled you up on behaviour in the playground in a gentle way. But whatever it was, generally they lived out, you know, every teacher says that they're working for your best interest, but they actually lived it out. They believed it, and you knew it. Well, I wanted you to do that exercise to kind of draw you into the world of service. It's an inverted world. It's not one that we're very used to. The world where caring for others is more important than personal comfort, where people's motivations are driven by other people's concerns rather than their own personal success. A world which is all about service and not status. It's an inverted world because whereas we only in our better moments acknowledge this inverted world in our admiration of others who are truly servants, and perhaps even more rarely want to live that way ourselves, God always acknowledges and approves and values this inverted world of service, as we see in Jesus. Jesus doesn't defeat sin and death by weight of his status alone. He doesn't have a might is right mentality. No, he has a might used right is right mentality. Might used in the service of others. Glory used for the benefit of the many. The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after 3 days he will rise. This is Jesus' favourite topic for the last few chapters in Mark. Ever since Peter's declaration of Jesus as the Christ in Mark chapter 8, Jesus turns his attention to filling in that title with all the proper connotations. You see, after being identified as God's Christ, God's King, God's Anointed One, he immediately told the disciples that he was going to Jerusalem to suffer and die and then be raised. And because this is all what he's all about, he has this bleak mission, he also tells a large crowd that if they really want to be his followers, they want to kind of do what he's doing, then they have to die to themselves. They have to pick up their cross daily, follow him. And with the disciples, he keeps reiterating over and over again, this is about the third time now, that he came to sacrifice himself. that he was going to rule, but rule from a cross. Because him on a cross was what would ransom many. He was using his authority for others. He was willingly going to enslave himself to the most gruesome and cursed of deaths, a God-forsaken kind of death, to liberate those who, unlike him, really did deserve to be God-forsaken. You see, he was in the world of service. He laid down his life for others. Now, the disciples took ages. It took ages for them to understand this, that this is what Jesus was on about, and therefore this is what they should be on about. As do most people still today. It's just confusing. Jesus on a cross is the centre of Christianity. It's familiar, but it's also just weird. And so several times, amidst this intense period of teaching, more private teaching of his disciples about his mission, Jesus finds the disciples kind of arguing amongst themselves about greatness, about privilege, about status, about who was going to be boss and who wasn't. And he has to sit down with them and teach them that disciples must be like God, that their discipleship must follow Christ into this inverted world of service. And you'll notice that there is a number of specific topics dealt with in these 20 verses that Danny read, but they all kind of revolve around this idea of service. Look in verse 50. Jesus concludes by saying, to be at peace with each other. Kind of rounding out how all of this started by the disciples arguing and not being at peace with each other. And it's just oxymoronic, isn't it, that Jesus is teaching them that he's going to Jerusalem to suffer and die, to give up his life, and then he kind of susses out that they're arguing about who amongst them is the greatest. It's just kind of, you know, like military intelligence or office works. It's just... So, three basic things for disciples to get to kind of enter into this inverted world. They all sound confusing, but they're nevertheless the true. You need to grow up younger. You need to broaden to be exclusive. And you mature by being inexperienced. Firstly, growing up younger. Verse 35, Jesus, sitting down, called the 12 and said, if anyone wants to be first, he must be the very last and the servant of all. Good way to enter this inverted world for us is to recognise what God truly values. That if you want to be first, that is really approved and affirmed by God, then you become last. You become a servant of all. If you want to grow up with God, advance in your discipleship, then you need to become a servant. And not just a servant of God, but a servant of all people. Now, the New Testament was originally written in Greek, and we translated it into English and all sorts of other languages, but actually, in the original language Greek, it was also kind of a translation, because Jesus spoke Aramaic, most commonly. And so even in writing the New Testament, it was a translation of the Aramaic, and the commentators tell me, I don't know Aramaic, but the commentators tell me that the word for servant and the word for child in Aramaic is the same word. It's maybe literally translated small one. And you just tell from the sentence whether you're talking about a small one physically, you know, child, or a small one status-wise, slave. And so to illustrate how to be first with God, or in other words, how to be the slave of all, Jesus quite literally takes a small one, a child, into their midst and welcomes him. He says to welcome small ones in my name. That's how you be a servant. Welcome small ones in my name. In other words, as per my character, welcome them. As per how I do it, welcome them. And if you welcome in that way, then you welcome me. Of course, that's true, because that's how I treat them. That's how I welcome them. And if you've welcomed me, then you've welcomed God, because that is what God is like too. You see, this inverted world is actually the true world, the really real world, the way God has made things. It's just how life works. And we know that, don't we? Sometimes the best doctors are not the ones out there making oodles of money, but the best doctors are the ones who take the home calls and visit people at home, all of those kinds of things. We very, very occasionally get glimpses of this real world, but it's the way life really is. The life of service. So, you want to welcome God? You want to be first? You want to grow up with God? Well, you become a small one. You become younger. You become like a child. And here are some ideas how. Welcome the small ones as per the character of Jesus by hanging out with the social small ones. Those who aren't socially adept, or as socially adept as you perhaps, you know, invite them to your party. Sit next to the awkward people in class. Or welcome the little ones as per the character of Jesus by helping the academic little ones. Those who do struggle in their studies more than you. Don't kind of be one-upmanship about it. Help them. Perhaps maybe biggest in Credo, I don't know. You're the judge. But welcome the little ones in Credo as per the character of Jesus by just being with those who aren't so active. I think Credo has got to be one of the most active and activist things going around. And there's lots that's right about that. I mean, it's not just because we're young and enthusiastic that we've got lots of energy, but we're motivated by the love of God. I mean, there's things to do. Let's, you know, and we all get out there and do our stuff. That's excellent. We're on a mission from God. But, you know, there are also small ones in this regard. Little ones. Ones who, for a whole bunch of reasons, just can't quite match the activity levels of others because of their emotional background or mental problems or whatever it is. And this is hard, isn't it? Because while most of you are in your activist, you know, you're actually serving others, and I don't want you to stop that. It's actually possible to kind of burn off and make others feel guilty if they don't kind of attain your standards. So just in your service, maybe slow down sometimes and even stop doing stuff, but just to be with those who aren't quite so active. So social little ones, academic little ones, activist little ones, and also you can take this quite literally, can't you? Just be with children. Actually, you know, they're valuable. Just because they can't produce and make money and all that kind of stuff. So, and I know lots of you help in Sunday school and youth group and all that. That's fantastic. But also, if God should bless you with parenthood, really, I think, take this to heart. I think mostly fathers, but also increasingly mothers, you know, career status, it's all kind of swamping. Just being with their kids, living in their world, walking alongside them. So grow up younger. Secondly, broaden to exclusivity. Teacher, said John, verse 38, we saw a man driving out demons in your name and we told him to stop because he was not one of us. Do not stop him, Jesus said. No one who does a miracle in my name can in the next moment say anything bad about me, for whoever is not against us is for us. I tell you the truth, anyone who gives you a cup of water in my name because you belong to Christ will certainly not lose his reward. So again, the disciples are acting like they have special privileges, that they have the kind of inside running to greatness because of something that maybe they're doing. like they're physically going along with Jesus, whereas this guy's not. Or maybe it's because of some special legitimacy, like back in chapter 6. If you flick back and see chapter 6, it's Jesus commissioned 12 disciples. Not 11, not 13, just 12. To go and do his stuff and have authority over demons. What's this 13th guy doing? He doesn't belong. I used to get quite upset a number of years ago. When did it start? Probably in the late 90s. When yet another Christian group, you know, set up at Yin. And usually they were kind of associated with a denomination or a specific church. It used to really rile me. Kind of, you know, I can't just go do that. What's got into them? But I think it was verses like this and other ones that really helped me to kind of accept that there is no room for pride or superiority. In disciples or in groups of disciples. It's not as if we have some special power in Credo, because, you know, back in my days it was basically Wednesday Mass or Credo. It was, you know. You know, we can't write on that, on history and all that sort of stuff. There's no special privileges for us. Really, any power that we have, any ability in ministry, is not ours, it's not our own, it's in the name of Jesus, you see. So, exclusivity to Jesus, loyalty to him, is not found in these other things. It's just about being for Jesus. Working for him, doing stuff in his name, pointing people to him. So much so that even something insignificant or seemingly insignificant, like getting a cup of water for someone in Christ's name, even something kind of as menial as that, you know, that doesn't win the masses at UTS to Christ, does it? Just helping, I don't know, set up afternoon tea or something. But even something like that, if it's done for and in the name of Christ, it's noted. It's approved by God. Now, please remember that next Monday night at AGM. All of you who do get elected to various roles, it's only because you're doing it in the name of Christ. If you don't get elected to roles, just remember, roles don't make people special. Serving a cup of water in the name of Christ is noted. Lastly, there's quite a long section here on maturing in inexperience. From verse 42, I won't read all of it again. If anyone causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to be thrown into the sea with a large millstone tied around his neck. If your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life maimed than with two hands to go into hell where the fire never goes out. The lives and the worlds of disciples need to be different from the crowd around, inverted. They need to become more and more green and immature in the ways of the world. They need to become naive when it comes to sin. We need to develop inexperience in these matters. Mature disciples show maturity by fighting sin. Ruthlessly, urgently, determinedly. Because unless they do, they'll lead little ones into sin by modelling bad behaviour or just showing that they don't really care, it doesn't really matter. Disciples are meant to be servants, remember? To help others, especially small ones. So if they misdirect even the least of the community, who would that be? The person you think, it doesn't matter if they fall away or go on in sin, they're pretty immature Christian anyway. We don't like them much anyway. Someone like that. Even the least, if you help model sin or direct them into sin somehow, oh, that's dire. Dire consequences. Deserving of great punishment. Again, Jesus' theme here is to emphasize the insignificant, isn't it? The least person, the small one, the struggling Christian. And one of the best ways that we can serve young Christians and struggling Christians, doubting Christians, even, you know, just smouldering wicked Christians, bruised reed Christians, Christians that can't pray anymore because, well, just because they can't. The best way of serving them is by going on all-out war on our own sin, our own misconduct, our own deceitful behaviour. So Jesus recommends radical action, doesn't he? If your hand causes you to sin, very concrete as well. How would your hand cause you to sin? Maybe by becoming a fist in violence or something instead of, you know, a palm in comfort. Come on, shape up, young Christian. Get with it. Instead of, you know, drawing alongside. If your foot causes you to sin, if your eye, you know, cut them off. It's better to be without those things than to go to hell. Now, we're supposed to be nailing Jesus' confusing teaching, so let me just clarify. I don't think Jesus is exactly talking literally here. He's just recommending radical stuff. Okay? So, I'll give you an example to illustrate this. I have probably a friend. Yeah, I'd call him a friend. We pray together, so. But he's also a kind of an associate. So there's two levels to the relationship. He's a married man, but he has real struggles with pornography on the internet. He just gets led into sin a lot. So he has taken the radical step of not knowing his computer's password. He just doesn't know it. His wife knows it, so that he can only be on the internet when she's there and around, and then he's not tempted. Now, I don't know about you, but that would drive me crazy if I couldn't access my stuff when Megan wasn't around. But no, he has taken radical, concrete steps to deal with sin. The seriousness of the warnings are just, it's impossible to get around them. And get the context. Jesus is talking to disciples here, okay? He's not talking to the crowds. It's a warning to us who say we're following Jesus, actually kind of enter his inverted world and follow him, including in the fight against sin. That's how I'm kind of taking verse 49 and 50 at the moment. I'm still not settled on how to read them, but basically I'm thinking everyone will be salted with fire. That is, everyone who loses their saltiness. If you don't become like Jesus and become a servant and loyal only to God and fighting against sin, it's like you're just bland, good for nothing, you know, saltless salt. And those kind of people, like in the verses above, will be in fire. Okay, so there's three things. Growing up young, broadening to exclusivity, and maturing in inexperience. Does all this sound just a bit different and unrealistic and kind of weird? Well, I can assure you that these ideas took some time to come to birth in the original disciples. I mean, if you read the whole of chapter 10, also deals with all of this thing. This comes up again and again, several times. The theme of needing to become like a child, of the necessity of service, not status. So can I encourage you that if you just feel like this is alien stuff, that's because it is. It's a whole different way of seeing life through God's perspective. And so just to kind of hang in there with it. Jesus will be very patient with you, like he was with the original disciples, if somewhat frustrated sometimes. But just hang in there. Don't just kind of dismiss it and discard it as Christian mumbo-jumbo. But for others, maybe apart from verse 49 and 50, there's not really much confusing here, is there? It's actually pretty straightforward. The difficult part about it is living it, doing it. So I'm going to conclude in this way. I'm going to give us about 4 minutes to reflect. Just maybe read the passage again. This song called Yahweh is going to be playing. Yahweh, by the way, is the personal name of God in the Bible, in case you're wondering. So you could look at those words. But I just want you, recognizing that this teaching is hard to do, let alone hard to understand, I just want to give you time to reflect.